Good evening, Sam. Welcome to the Space Show.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We think here in Australia of NASA as being the pinnacle of technology, and you've done some pretty amazing things over the years, but presumably to keep at the cutting edge, you have to keep keep at it, as it were, developing new technologies. How's that going?
Well, actually, what we're looking for is a very technology-rich future. We see putting more complex and lower-cost spacecraft about the Earth in order for us to understand the dynamics of our planet, to look at resource allocation, to exploit resource allocation, and in effect understand our planet in terms of all countries using, exploiting, and preserving the natural resources, and understanding such diverse phenomena as hurricanes, El Nino effect. This past year, you had record droughts in Australia. We had record floods in North and South America. And for the first time, we were able to look at predicting a season in advance, this El Nino phenomena. And what we would like to do is not just do it in 6 months in advance, but really understand decadal weather patterns, so that we have a better understanding of preparation, the impact on countries and the economy. So looking down at Earth is one major asset. As we move into away from Earth, our deep space, with our missions to Mars, a Pathfinder, got worldwide attention last year. We're looking at having one mission out to the planets every 26 months with the same order of magnitude reduction of cost. Previously, we were spending over $1 billion on a planetary mission. 10 years in the making, $1 billion, U.S. dollars. What we're looking at now are 2 to 3 year mission cycle times, and on the order of $200 to $300 million. So as we move into this, as Dan Golden calls it, faster, better, cheaper age, we're looking at bringing more technology into our baseline in order to move these programs out. And then the last area, human spaceflight, as 16 countries move towards putting the International Space Station in place beginning late this year, we're going to get to an unprecedented era of human spaceflight, learning to exploit the microgravity environment, learning to live and work in space, and get setting the stage for humans moving out of low Earth orbit in a 20-year period of time, perhaps missions back to the moon, to Mars, and beyond. So we're looking at a technology foundation that really, in effect, says you haven't seen anything yet from the space program.
And how are you going about doing that? Is most of this technology being developed in-house by NASA, or by private industry independently you buy it, or do they develop it under contract to you?
Well, actually, both. We maintain our 10 research centers and development centers in our country, but what we look at is a partnership between NASA, industry, and universities, where universities are intellectually rich for a fundamental research baseline in order to provide the innovation of new ideas, and bringing university partnerships into our laboratories, and our partnerships with industry gives us almost a three-legged stool to look at a technology vision in terms of ideas, attributes of new systems, exploiting the information technology revolution in terms of thinking spacecraft, so that we can have systems that physically think and perform like human beings, so that we have another level of autonomy and attributes of the scientist put in with the rover in order to move to a next generation of exploration of planets, as well as putting systems of constellation spacecraft in low Earth orbit that provides communication and linkage that does more on board the spacecraft, less on the ground, and dramatically lowers our life cycle costs. So think in terms of farmers in the United States, Australia, Europe, being able to sit at a terminal at their resident, send commands up, very simple English natural language commands that allows them to draw directly down to them their understanding of water, drought, crop, pesticides, from a fleet of systems in Earth orbit that in effect raises the quality of life of individuals as well as impacting our understanding of the Earth. So that's the level of activity we're looking at having in the future.
So you're seeing a time when the individual end user actually has more direct contact with the data collection.
Yes. If you think in terms of the internet today, I can sit anywhere in the world and get access to information on a global basis. Well, we would look at the equivalent of an internet in space, where in effect a user would be seamlessly linked in to systems just like the internet has information products on a terrestrial basis. You would be able to task and obtain information about your needs from an internet-based product system that would be space-derived instruments, sensors, and systems that allow to have data collected and not provide you data, but provide you knowledge about what systems functions you need, whether you're planning disaster relief, whether you're planning resource allocation, mining operations, mapping of urban patterns, but in effect, individual users being able to access and acquire that information almost near instantaneously.
So take us, say, here in Victoria, we might have a fire, you know, bushfire going on, and the people involved in managing that, the relief operation, the firefighting and so on, might actually be able to call up data from a satellite that's passing overhead and have it returned to them already processed.
Yes, that's right, real-time data. And in fact, it wouldn't just be the image of the fire, but even the characteristic of the material, so that they could get an idea of, eucalyptus with the oil rich, or the dry brush and the moisture or the lack of moisture, the characteristics of the plant material that would actually lead to better understanding of the fire spreading other than just the image of the fire.
So they have a better idea where it's going to go.
Yes, and how plan a strategy to contain it.
At the moment, of course, so what happens is you've got to order from a large provider like Landsat or EOSAT or a Spot Image, and several days later you might be lucky to get an image that you then have to send to some provider who will process it for you.
That's right. So in effect, what we're looking at is the value-added retailer becomes the intelligence in the system, so that you aren't really buying the product per se, that you're getting the product immediately when you need it and how you need it. So. And that's really the concept we have for the future space assets as they relate to providing benefits to Earth. And likewise, science students and educators at all levels, primary, secondary, university level, would in effect have access to internet-based type capability. I'm using internet for the notional idea of being able to access, but you would be having your school lessons using information from a fleet of airplanes and rovers on the surface and digging through the substrates of Mars.
We already saw the beginnings of that when people could just download material from the Pathfinder, for example, straight away. But we're looking even further at intimate involvement in it.
Yeah, that's correct. Even to the point where individual scientists would be tasking, and the space assets would be sorting out the task commands and performing search and analysis of data coming directly from the scientists.
That means, of course, that this data has to be pretty cost-effective. How do you go about billing an end user and this sort of thing?
Well, we're starting at the idea of intelligence and autonomy. And intelligence means simply that, putting levels of capability at the system, at the end, the smart sensor, the intelligence at the collector site, the intelligence in the networking, and the intelligent agents that in effect represent and understand your needs to make these interconnects and linkaging from your point sitting on Earth up through the vast terrestrial satellite link communication. So in effect, it's transparent and seamless to you, and the intelligent attributes that are the mainstream of pulling these capabilities into your say living room is the idea. So we're really looking at information technology and attributes of future computational and networking, the networking ties as well as the computational in states become a much driver for the whole global attributes of our future systems. And that's not just spacecraft, your car, your home, the idea of layered intelligence and layered processing chips, you know, the size of a sugar cube, that becomes a buildup of in effect, a distributed information-rich technology, really becomes almost what the science fiction writers have created for their view of the future. That reality is almost here.
You work with lots of other countries, and you must have some systems in place in order to enable these various, Japan, Europe, and other people to work together, especially on the International Space Station. How have you gone about doing that, and what developments can we see in the future?
Well, what we're working today is, in effect, the way we worked in the 1960s, in terms of we have electronic email instead of letters and phone, twisted pair phone connections, and we have fiber cables between most countries. But in effect, the process, the engineering tools we use, and the way that we deal interactions on collaborative, whether it's distributed in the United States or distributed on a global scale, we pretty much are using the same type of processes that go back 30 years. And what we're looking at is to build on this idea of the information age and the ability to integrate and, in effect, warp virtual teams together so that you and I are sitting in this room together. Well, if I was in the United States, you're in Australia, we would have the capability, infrastructure to, in effect, work face-to-face, view each other in a three-dimensional environment, view a product development in a three-dimensional environment, and interact and work in design space state as if we're sitting in a group together, and bring other people in and out of that environment so that a degree of simulation becomes one of not sitting in front of a computer screen and transmitting information, but dealing with a multimedia-rich environment of dealing with sight, sound, heat, all the attributes of the way human beings think and create. We're looking at, over the next 20 years, creating a vision that allows people to work in that media-rich, information-rich environment and design and look at end-to-end products from a conceptual to operational, all within this virtual product environment, so that distributed, globally dispersed teams can, in effect, work as one, and dealing with such diverse issues as cultural barriers, a natural language, and a way to deal with translation and viewing issues that transcend cultural barriers that exist across various countries as well.
And this will be affordable, not just to NASA and the other space agencies and to perhaps the fewest, biggest companies, but to what might quote ordinary business or even education?
Oh, absolutely. We actually see, if you think in terms of education, you literally are in a buildingless, wallless environment. So the idea of a brick and mortar and large institutions really changes the whole idea of what education, what university environments mean. You have people, in effect, use telephone lines to have distributed education, people talking to professors through video links and phone links. Now think in terms of an environment where students literally can be brought into any setting. The classroom setting could be on the surface of Mars with their professor, and moving into these rooms that allows one to warp anywhere into an environment at any time from any location. This may sound far-fetched, but in the United States, what this is being driven primarily by is the entertainment industry. You see a lot of Hollywood hiring most of the students coming out with this background, this training, and this understanding of this information technology. And what we don't want to do is see this become the purview of the entertainment industry, warping people into movies. If you just look at the last 3 to 5 years of the type of movies and special effects, this is all being brought about by this digital information revolution. And they talk in terms of scanning and warping actors in the movies now, two-dimensional aspects of what I'm talking about. So where we're looking at it is, not let this become entertainment driven, but how to understand and exploit this in terms of the engineering driven and for uses strictly beyond the entertainment. This is a $1 billion plus industry in the United States today.
Do you see a day when the autonomy of space vehicles will be so great and the ability to bring back imagery and data and view samples in different ways will be so great that we wouldn't actually need to send people to the moon or Mars or anywhere?
Actually, what we're looking at is when we talk about sending people out and solving the life support and the issues associated with sustaining life and mitigating risk in a harsh environment, we're actually looking for humans going to Mars when there's a pressing need and an understanding of what they would do there, how they would function, and not having humans, Mars, and then rovers, but an unprecedented idea of human-machine partnership to exploit the attributes of thinking machines along with certain aspects of human presence. It's really a blend of human machine intelligence and ability that in effect uses machines that would be as an amplification of a small group of humans, that a machine partnership would expand that force capability of a few humans literally into a hundredfold of capability if that right partnership was structured.
Well, Sam, how would you see the world in perhaps, say, 20 years' time with this technology that you're working with applied freely around the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we see this technology explosion that seems to be almost at the advancements of the microprocessor computer level going, creation of new materials, untold ability to deal with information on a global scale and creation of knowledge on a global scale that would really touch on everyone's lifestyle and, in effect, looking at how one improves the quality of life. If we think in terms of the smart spacecraft and the simulation environments that I've talked about, that obviously would find its way into your automobile, into your home. The microprocessor that's in your microwave oven has its origins in the development of technology in the 1950s, starting with the transistor, the integrated circuit, and now you have these smart little pieces of silicon that's embedded everywhere throughout all the products in your house, from your car to your microwave, your television, your stereo. And as we move into this another era, the computing or the information product of the home, the idea of a smart home, a smart product, a mobile nomadic environment, almost a bubble of information that moves with you from site to site. There's really no longer looking at people getting in their cars, moving into a central location in the city to work, but a distributed workforce, a different way of working in a community, living, working in a community that doesn't involve commuting in your automobile, but telecommunication, better understanding of our planet, as I mentioned earlier, understanding weather, predicting weather, seasonal effects, even decadal weather phenomena, and looking at resource planning, utilization of resources better, global partnerships in terms of commitment to, if you think about it, half the people in the world have never used a telephone. And so when you start from that basic fact, we have a long way to go to deal with the quality of life and ensuring a uniform quality of life on this planet. So I look at the path we're on and a small part that technology organizations like NASA can make, as well as people around the world, is moving much more forward into bringing all humanity up to a better state of health care, quality of life, and improvement in actually basic living conditions and a living lifestyle that enhances what inherently is in every human being inherent creativity to expand and to grow.
Well, thank you for joining us tonight on the Space Show, Sam.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you very much.